Hello and welcome to the IJ Global podcast, InfraDig. For those of you who so far have resisted the temptation to Google InfraDig, oh, maybe that sort of thing just is beneath you. My name is Angus Leslie Melville, and I'm editorial director of IJ Global Infrastructure Journal. It is my delight and pleasure to host this podcast series where we delve into all things infrastructure and energy. In these podcasts, I talk to infrastructure specialists about the procurement, financing, delivery, and operation of some of the most significant projects around the world. Today, I have with me Ian Dixon, an infrastructure professional who has one of the most all-encompassing exposures to this sector and needs little introduction. But let me introduce them all the same. Ian is recently retired from a career that has spanned more than 30 years in global infrastructure financing market, ranging from being a banker, monoliner, investment banker, and finishing off with a stint as a credit rater. For those of you who understand all that, he's pretty much done it all across the whole financing stack for infrastructure and energy. I've known Ian for the best part of 20 years, and he's still talking to me, so it can't have been all bad. Ian is the second person I brought onto InfraDig following Dr. Tim Stone, CBE, who has been focusing on the financing of nuclear. Tim will be back with us next week for the third and final podcast in our nuclear series. But for now, we have Ian Dixon. Welcome to InfraDig.
Thank you, Angus, for that very kind introduction. It's a real pleasure to join your InfraDig podcast. And yeah, what an honour it is to follow Dr. Tim. And indeed, I understand Dr. Tim's going to be next as well. Indeed, I've been very lucky in my career to look at many different types of global infrastructure assets from a number of different approaches. Mainly, my roles have needed me to look longer term and what changes there could be to the operating environment which could impact an asset. But Angus, not everything is easily predictable, as seen over the last 3 years specifically.
No, I've got a funny feeling that's your ratings agency experience speaking there. It's only ever an opinion, eh? But let's get down to business. Ian, we're sticking with energy for this podcast. Really, I'm going to have to do something on infrastructure soon, but energy is so much flavor of the day that it's dominating my early podcasts. Having said that, well, I've got some corkers lined up in the coming weeks that are very much focused on infrastructure, mostly transport for the first ones. I'm just going to say Dublin, Edinburgh. I know there's a very sort of European focus, but it will become more internationally focused. There's just some things I'm needing to say right now. But here we sit for this virtual fireside chat, and it rather begs the question, Ian, what should we be burning on our fires these days?
Well, Angus, what an interesting first question. However, nowadays, I'm not sure that's an easy answer. Burning coal is obviously out of the question. Wood is not ideal. Gas is becoming very unpopular. So I think we're left with an electric fire if we can really ensure the electricity is actually green.
Yeah, simple. Well, bloody cheek. Anyway, as we look at it, coal, that's evil. Gas, well, some people would call that transition. The generous would, anyway. The virtuous would say it also is evil. Wood, well, that's a preserve of biomass, and some of that's shipped all over the world, which its carbon footprint is quite horrendous. But that aside, green electricity seems to be the only answer, as you rightly say. Now, there's a lot of renewables out there being procured, built, and a lot of megawatts already in operation. But is it realistic to expect that we'll be able to power all our energy needs from green resources?
Yeah, good question, Angus. And look, in an ideal future world, the answer has got to be yes. But we really don't live in an ideal world, do we? Obviously, there's been a fundamental change over the last month, given Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And this is going to lead to a significant change in the European and global energy markets. While net zero will be in every government's key target, it is likely to take very much second fiddle to security of supply. As reported in the press today, European countries will want to ensure their energy requirements are self-generated or widely diversified as far as possible. For example, Germany would be happier if they were not reliant on gas coming from Russia and be able to turn off Nord Stream 1, never mind turn on Nord Stream 2. On the positive side for net zero, this will mean greater investment in solar, wind and nuclear, as well as other renewable technologies, but that's going to take some time. On the negative side for net zero, they could be restarting or keeping coal-fired power plants running for longer with domestic coal, increased localized fracking, which is not popular in some parts, and building LNG terminals to help diversification supply. So while undoubtedly many governments have signed up to tough net zero targets, geopolitics will have a significant impact on the timing of achieving this.
Ian, you're starting to sound like a politician. Actually, when I think about it, that wouldn't be too bad an evolution for your career. Frankly, it'd be nice to have somebody in power who actually understands what's going on. But you're also displaying the worst traits of a politician. I'm not sure you really answered my question there. Can the globe really expect to be able to produce all of its power needs from renewable resources? Answer the question, man.
Firstly, I don't think I'd make a good politician. So let's see if I can actually answer your question. While the UK can clearly transition towards net zero with greater reliance on clean energy, some countries will take decades to achieve this. The great Dr. Tim outlined that even the UK must build 10 gigawatts of new low-carbon primary energy per year from 2025 to 2050, and that's a huge commitment. However, at least the UK has the capability and the operating environment to build and finance bigger offshore wind facilities, additional solar facilities, new nuclear facilities, including small modular reactors and other renewables. Even though the UK has a relatively small population against other countries and our GDP per capita is higher, achieving net zero is going to be a real challenge for the UK. But if you look at developing economies like Indonesia, for example, who have a growing population and a growing economy, i.e. a growing need for more power, it will take multiple decades for them and countries like them to realistically achieve net zero.
Okay. For a long time now, we at IJ Global have been reporting on the likes of, say, hydro and geothermal projects in Indonesia. Recently in our news, we've been writing about the likes of, and please excuse my pronunciation, Bintang Bano on the hydropower front and a couple of geothermal plants, both of them weigh in at 55 megawatts, Patua and Dieng facilities. And that is just naming a few that off the top of my head, clearly not off the tip of my tongue, though. I suppose the question has to be, can they transition, like the UK, to net zero?
Angus, I'm sending to you on pronunciations. I think you did a very good job there. I'm not good at that, but I can see you taking notes on how many times I mentioned net zero. It is an admission that not everything can achieve zero greenhouse gas emissions. That's a useful target to aim to, where emissions produced will be balanced by those that are absorbed. Of course, any country can aim to transition to net zero, but some will take much longer. For example, at COP26, India announced that it would achieve net zero by 2070. Oh, yeah. I know some people were disappointed with that long date, but it acknowledges that it's going to take a long time and it's not going to be an easy task for certain countries. Indeed. Now, countries like Indonesia can't build enough renewables to meet their growing power demands, never mind replace current thermal power plants. Indeed, Indonesia announced that over the next 10 years, they will build up to 41 gigawatts of new power plants. That's ambitious, but they anticipate that 50% of them will be fossil fuels and 50% awesome. Will be renewable. Okay. To give credit to Indonesia, they have set a target of 23% of its energy to come from renewable sources by 2025 and 31% by 2050, respectively. So Angus, some of your listeners are going to be a little confused here about why Indonesia was going to take that time. And I think it should put it into a little bit of context and try and keep it relatively simple. So the UK has a population of 68 million people versus Indonesia's 276 million people. Mm-hmm. Power usage per capita in the UK is 4,500 kilowatt hours, whereas in Indonesia it's 1,000 kilowatt hours. Now, 20 years ago, power usage in the UK was 6,500 and Indonesia was 500. Mm-hmm. So the UK has reduced usage per capita by 25% during that time period, where Indonesia has increased by 100%. Mm. GDP per capita is an interesting one because it's $45,000 per capita in the UK and 10,000 in Indonesia. But normalized GDP growth, while that's 1% in the UK, is 4% in Indonesia. So in essence, Indonesia's population is four times the size of the UK. Per capita, it uses four times less power than the UK. And GDP per capita is, again, four times less than the UK. But growth is four times higher than the UK. On top of this, I think you need to understand that coal power production in Indonesia is 55% versus 5% in the UK. And clean fuel power in the UK is over 50% nuclear and wind, and nearly 20% for Indonesia. Your reported geothermal and hydro transactions come to mind. So the direction of travel is that Indonesia needs significant more power, and not all of it can come from clean energy sources over the next couple of decades. I want to be clear, Angus, I'm not picking on Indonesia. I could have picked on several developing economies and compared them to developed economies. And while the numbers will be not the same, you will find a very similar trend.
Totally. So what you're saying is, is it up to the Western world to help them build offshore wind like we've seen, say, in Taiwan? Now, a great example of that is the 298-megawatt Zhongning offshore wind farm. Again, apologies for my pronunciation. Now, this project is being delivered by a JV of China Steel and Copenhagen Infrastructure Partners. And interestingly, the project finance debt was actually dominated by Taiwanese lenders. For us, Taiwan is particularly interesting as the government is preparing by June to kick off its third auction round for 1.5 gigawatts of offshore wind. That's an interesting development for us to be tracking. The company is doing the actual hard work on Zhongneng offshore wind farm, include the likes of Vestas for the turbines, Tsingda Marine Structures, that's a subsidiary of China Steel, on jacket foundations, Ramble feed for jacket foundations, and Seaway 7 to lay the submarine cable system, of course. There's a lot of regional participation on that particular deal, but you see international developers and financiers and advisors playing a significant role in delivering programs of this nature, yes?
Yeah, I mean, yes, I do. And I like the way you're thinking. It's impressive what they're achieving in Taiwan and other countries in Asia. There are significant renewable projects ongoing. And I've seen many European counterparties involved. But countries like Indonesia, China, and India have other issues, as they have big domestic coal industries which form part of their economy. So these coal mines cannot be closed tomorrow, as thousands of job losses will be incurred. Indeed. This is no different to what happened in other countries like the US and Germany in the past. E.g., there are certain states in the US, Wyoming and West Virginia, where most of their economy is built around the coal. With gas prices being higher and likely to be for a while, it would not surprise me if some old coal-fired power plants become economic again. Let's not forget, the only reasons the UK closed its mines is because they were uneconomic. We could import coal cheaper than extract it ourselves. So it's more about being fortuitous than necessarily the UK being ahead of the curve. We should not forget where the Industrial Revolution started.
Good Lord, Ian. You're older than I thought. You remember the Industrial Revolution? My goodness, that's an admission and a half.
Well, I always find it very interesting to look at history and who had economic power at certain times. So the first availability of wood helped cultures build boats, develop trade routes, and conquer other countries. And then came along coal. And when that arrived, it created wealth and the Industrial Revolution, as mentioned. And then eventually we ended up with oil and gas markets developing, and that created wealth for certain countries and superpowers, as we now know. So the question is, will renewables be the driver of wealth going forward? Can't see it myself, and maybe we should be looking at a different industry where economic power will be great.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. But let's bring it back to the coal industry, everyone's favourite whipping post. What you described there sounds very much to me like protectionism. But surely there are other countries that import coal from coal-rich countries. So surely this should be curtailed quicker? What do you reckon to that?
Indeed, there are countries who continue to export coal. And I think the same issues apply. Protectionism for the coal exporting countries like Indonesia, Australia, and indeed Russia, who want to protect local economies around the coal extraction and transportation. And those countries who are importing coal, like China and India, who have the economic growth and reliant on that coal import. So if exporting countries stop exporting, it would cause major issues in both the countries, but for very different reasons. Both the exporting and importing countries would need to transition at the same time, but the dependency on each other do make it a more complicated process. So I don't see it being quicker.
Okay, Ian. But we do continue to see finance being achieved on coal-fired power plants, coal terminals, and coal mining companies. Don't like to be judgmental. We do probably hand out awards for these. That's a different matter entirely. I'm not being a hypocrite in the slightest, please. The question for you right here now has to be, should banks, investment banks, investors, and ratings agencies stop helping these entities finance themselves? And maybe we should stop giving them awards as well. But let's turn this on the industry and...
Thanks, Angus. I see it's now time for the tough question, although I thought this was going to be a friendly fireside chat. After what I said at the beginning, in an ideal future world, yes. But these transactions have been financed. The assets are not obsolete yet. They will be in due course when the world gradually transitions. And maybe these assets will find it hard to refinance, but they remain essential assets until such time as alternative forms of energy are available to replace them. So while banks, investment banks, investors, and rate agencies may choose their own strategy as they're involved with these assets and other assets, I think the difficulty is supporting new build or expansion of assets. Also, where a country is not taking steps to transition, albeit over a long period of time, it would have to make whoever you are think twice about your involvement.
Oh, Ian, that political career beckons once again. You dodged that one, frankly. At the outset, you mentioned gas is becoming unpopular. So how are we going to transition away from gas?
Good point. It's going to take much longer than coal. And frankly, transitioning out of coal is not going to be in my lifetime. And again, different countries or regions will have different issues relating to gas, as we said previously. As mentioned earlier, though, countries will focus on being independent and may reduce importing gas if they can, or increase domestic production if they can. Like coal, if a country has domestic gas supply, the slower they will be at reducing its use. Additionally, some countries have significant reliance on gas outside of gas-fired power plants. For example, the UK has many homes reliant on gas for cooking and heating. there will have to be a governmental-led approach to support conversion away from gas to cooking and heating through renewable electricity. It can be done, but transition timelines are going to be longer in certain countries and regions. And we should not forget that over 25% of the world are still cooking and heating by using fuels like kerosene. Mm-hmm.
Yes, indeed. Yep, indeed. And frankly, without gas, I'll never walk anything again because it just doesn't work properly on electric. But I'm kind of surprised that you haven't mentioned reliance on oil and gas products for the transport sector. When will the transport sector be fully environmentally friendly?
Well, that's another can of worms, isn't it? I assume you mean net zero, because some of the transportation sectors are going to struggle to be fully environmentally friendly, but they can all transition to net zero, albeit will take time.
Okay. Hit me with some examples.
You just want more details, don't you? So let's
always
bring it down.
Always. And if you can tell me the price of debt, I'm always keen to... No, no, that's a separate story.
let's break it down if we can. So ships, if the international shipping sector were a country in its own right, it would be sixth or seventh largest greenhouse gas emitter. Maritime regulations have been adopted to reduce emissions, e.g. the Fuel EU Maritime Proposal, otherwise known as Fit for 55 package. Vessels would have to be adapted to run off new, cleaner fuels like advanced biofuels, renewable methanol, hydrogen, which you've reported on regularly, biomethane, etc. The availability and cost of each fuel, as well as the energy density of the fuel and the implications in terms of onboard storage, are going to be key issues for them. So it's possible for the sector to get to net zero, but it will take a number of decades. Airplanes. The global aviation industry caused about 2% of all greenhouse gas emissions. That's pre-pandemic, as you would appreciate. The airline industry main lobby group adopted a target of achieving net zero by 2050. Aircraft manufacturers have indeed made aircraft more fuel efficient. But interesting, the amount of fuel burned per passenger dropped by 24% between 2005 and 2017. But any environmental benefit was outpaced by 60% growth in air traffic. Alternative sustainable aviation fuels will help, but it is expensive and still scarce, and purchasing carbon offsets has been criticized as ineffective. With airlines' priority now is on to increased demand in the aftermath of the pandemic, I really can't see this sector being net zero by 2050.
No.
Government transportation is the easiest sector, but it will need capital investment to convert all government ground transportation to electric. Certainly, some cities have done this with electric buses, trams, trains, service trucks, etc. Also, they've encouraged taxis to be electric as well as other vehicles. So a continued trend in this direction is inevitable. Commercial vehicles, again, I think we'll see a gradual transition towards all electric delivery vans and trucks. Other technologies will also be used as biofuels and hydrogen. And domestic cars, a lot written about domestic cars. Again, we're seeing a gradual transition driven by government policy. There are some roadblocks, sorry about the puns there. Availability of electric cars has been a key issue recently. The price of electric cars is not competitive with other cars, and distance an electric car can travel, as well as the availability of electric charging points, although a lot of investment going in place there. So there are more people aware of the need to be greener, and this will also drive, yet another fun, the change to domestic travel methods. Timelines are going to be different in certain countries, states and regions. So I think I've covered most types of transportation, but it's all going to be very different across the globe.
Indeed. You've done an excellent job there, talking about numerous sectors in transport. And, you know, I can actually report that we've got a chap ripping out our ensuite bathroom at the moment. And at the start of last week, he actually took receipt of his electric van. He's done nothing but complain about his charging ever since. But that aside, now, So talking about these sectors, that's been interesting, but you've disappointed our audience. Not once have you mentioned ESG, sustainability finance, or Dr. Tim Stone's nuclear green bonds. If you keep on like this, our listeners are going to question your credibility. Over to you.
Oh dear, I'm sorry I've disappointed you and your listeners, Angus. But of course, during my last few years at Fitch Ratings, the investors I talked to were all keen to understand our views on ESG, sustainability finance, or green bonds. It is a very big topic, and I think you should leave that one for another guest around your virtual fire. However, while this is an important issue, I naturally come at these issues from a point of view of where the credit risk is. As to me, it's not about the label like green bond. It's about what risks there are. So looking at ESG risk, does the business have increased costs to ensure it meets all rules and regulations around ESG, whatever those risks happen to be? And are there likely to be changes in such regulations which could impact the business and how the business is protecting themselves, and that could increase their costs? And is the nature of their business such that investors may not want to fund going forward, and therefore access to fresh capital is going to be an issue for them? There's those kind of risk issues outside the normal credit risk issues I've been looking at. As mentioned, I do think it's a bigger topic for another day, and you should keep your fire burning.
Oh, I'll keep that fire burning, and don't you worry about that. Ian, thank you so much for your time today. That's been really interesting, and I've enjoyed chatting with you enormously, as always.
Thank you.
Let's leave it there for today. So, no, thank you. Let's leave it there for today. It's been a bit longer a podcast than usual. Next one, I shall endeavor to limit to my preferred 20 minutes or less. But sometimes you just need time to crack open a subject properly. Join me next week for the final installment of the nuclear series with Dr. Tim Stone. Until then, I hope you found this podcast to be anything but InfraDig.